So the first day I spoke a little bit about sati. And yeah, sati is the foundation of our practice. Sometimes it's translated as mindfulness, but I think that word's been kind of overused, and it's best to avoid it at this point, because certainly the way it's being used in the world these days is not the way the Buddha used it. It's not the understanding, I think. Sati is the still heart. Sati is the thinking heart. Sati is the listening heart. And one of the foundational texts in our tradition is the Satipatthana Sutra. I spoke a little bit about the Anapanasati, ana being in-breath, apana being out-breath. Sati is recollection in that sense. And the Satipatthana, again, it is being completely present to the nature of the unfolding world. And patthana is like a foundation, a basis. I like to think sometimes, you know, of our life as being a lot like a weaving. And the foundation of that weaving is the warp of the threads. And then in that foundation there is, are there the threads and the wool that make up the particulars of our life. And we are all weaving a life individually and together. Our thoughts, our actions, are like the what creates the tapestry of life, of our life. You know, at this point in the retreat, we've gotten down to some of the basic questions, I think, that come to us in meditation as things that we need to resolve for ourselves. It's like we start to get to the true heart of the questions of our lives once we start to get a little bit quiet. Questions about suffering, questions about death, ours and others. And these are good and important questions, because inevitably there is no way we can escape looking at them in a human life. These are the very questions that arise from the consciousness that makes us unique as human beings. Where do we come from? Where are we going? Who am I? How is it that the world is so inextricably beautiful and so filled with suffering at the same time? And we've settled into quiet, into the still heart, for those questions to arise, but also for the answers to come. As soon as we start speaking about answers, though, we start to think, oh, I'm supposed to do something. We think about suffering, we think I'm supposed to fix something, I'm supposed to change it, or I'm supposed to attain something, some understanding. But it's really important that we come with no goals, with open hands and a still heart. The fundamental orientation of turning within is simply to return to the world, not our idea of the world, but the world as it is and its original quality. We can call it the still heart. We can also call it the warp of life. You know, when we look at our lives, we can see the texture and the pattern and the richness of the tapestry that we have woven. But we don't see the warp necessarily, which is the basis or the foundation, the essence of our existence. Dogen said, "We don't know and see everything that's here. There's something more." We've been chanting about that all week. We've been chanting about form is emptiness, emptiness is form, form is exactly emptiness, emptiness is exactly form. I read about it this morning in Tori Zenji. When I look at the real nature of the universe, I see that all is the never-failing manifestation of the mysterious truth of the Tathagata. Each particle of matter, each moment, is none other than the glorious revelation of this mysterious light. So these are our wise teachers pointing to something, something that we don't know and we don't see, but that is the basis of existence. And that we as human beings have these questions and have this wondering is the uniqueness of who we are and is so important. Without these questions, we can't see into this nature. So in the original teachings of the Buddha, he gave us a path. The very first thing he taught was about the Three Noble Truths, Four Noble Truths. And the first one I spoke about a little bit in the second Dharma talk, that dukkha, which is, you know, just kind of discomfort, uneasiness, wanting something, wanting it to be a little different, you know, just, it's not necessarily outright suffering as we understand suffering in the world, yeah, the horrors, the real horrors of the world. But it's more personal than that, and just... And the First Noble Truth says that dukkha, it has to be seen and understood. And this is what is meant by being intimate. It is this dukkha that gives rise to the desire to practice. Is this dukkha, these unanswered questions, that how is the world absolutely perfect while millions are suffering still? How do we hold those things? When we sit down on the cushion and begin our meditation, as we have throughout this week together, you know, various thoughts, feelings, perceptions come to visit us, come to sit with us. And we might be sitting and our body just feels uncomfortable and we just want to get out of here. And the Satipatthana Sutra says that we sit right in the middle of whatever our body presents us. If it's sleepiness or drowsiness, we sit right there in the middle of it. We come back to our breath and we know that we're falling asleep, or we know that there's a pain in our leg. And, you know, what immediately comes up is what can I do about this? Or do I need to do something about this? And to the degree that we're able to see it for what it is, whatever the discomfort is, acknowledge it and come back, it is allowing it to be just as it is. And it's really essential that our heart begins to find the way to know this, that when we see something coming up of discomfort, whether it's body, feelings, in our mind, thoughts, It might be, I really don't like what's happening, such and such a place, or I really don't like this situation. How do I fix it? I really don't like that I get anxious in this situation. Any of those things, just any of those things can be. And we see it. And that's the first noble truth, is we have to see it. We have to recognize it. And in recognizing it, acknowledge it and allow it. And we allow it by creating a lot of space. We know it's there. And we let it maybe sit off to the side. We don't look right at it. But it's kind of sitting off here to the side. And we breathe in and we breathe out. And it comes back, the thought comes back, the feeling comes back, the sleepiness comes back. And once again, right away we acknowledge it, ah yes. And the allowing of it does not mean that we indulge in it. The allowing doesn't mean that we get caught and we follow it. The allowing means that we know it's there. And still we're willing to be right here. Sometimes it helps to ask a question. Is there something beneath this? Is there something more here than just what's being presented? Many of you have heard these stories before, but that when I was first sitting at Kokoan, that I used to design space, houses. And at one point, I asked myself, what's beneath this? What am I avoiding with this? I mean, I had to see and acknowledge that, oh yeah, this is my fantasy, this is where I get dispersed, this is where I disappear. This is what takes me away. And in the taking it, as soon as I could acknowledge that, okay, this is taking me away, why? And ask a question of it. Again, not pushing it away, but being very open to the fact that this is a fantasy that takes me away from something. And as soon as I acknowledged that, then I was free of it. I was able to start coming back. And what really needed my attention appeared. And it was, of course, something I wanted to avoid. But in the coming back, we begin to establish a certain level of concentration in that place of allowing and open-heartedness in stillness. We begin to develop a certain amount of concentration, and in that concentration, then whatever is there, we can be there with it. It pulls us away, we come back. We get caught in it again, we come back. We know it's there. It's okay it's there. It's okay it pulls us away. The practice of sati is the coming back. That's all sati is coming back. Remembering right here. And bit by bit we sink into this place of concentration, and what needs our attention can begin to move closer to us. And in the moving closer, we get more steady. It has less power to pull us away. It's not so far away from us anymore. It's getting closer. And we have more willingness to be here and let it be. And it moves closer and closer until finally it's sitting right there in our lap. And we're able to, as Tayo says, embrace it. But even more important, at some point it becomes who we are. We are completely intimate with it. There is no separation at all. And in that space, the great heart of the Buddha, the essential threads of our existence, come forth. And we feel a deep well of compassion. And it's the healing. And the healing only happens in oneness. And we can't make it happen. We can't do anything about it. We can only keep coming back. Body in the body, without aversion or attachment. That's what the Satipatthana Sutra says. Feelings in the feelings. That means absolutely one. We are absolutely one with the feelings. It's not feelings and I'm going to be in the feelings. The feelings are right here with us. Feelings in the feelings without aversion or attachment. We're not trying to fix anything. We're not trying to change anything. It is the well of compassion, the bright, illuminated mind of the Buddha that holds us there. And often, there are tears. Ajahn Chah says if we haven't wept many times in our practice, then we have not begun our practice. I think that's true. Thinking thoughts in the thought, mental formations in the mental formations. Thinking in the thinking without aversion or attachment. When we're thinking, we know we're thinking and we're coming back. And at some point we know exactly what to do. Objects of mind and the objects of mind. No separation, no objects of mind out there. Objects of mind and the objects of mind, which means everything else that is in our consciousness is an object of mind without aversion or attachment. Clearly comprehending. And that's the First Noble Truth. Dukkha is seen, comprehended, and it is the heart of compassion. And it is then that we can let go, which is the Second Noble Truth. What has arisen, we can let go of. And in that resolution, in that heart of compassion, the resolution is already there, the solution is already there. The freedom is already there. We could say we let go of the arising, but really it lets go of us. And we feel resolved and at peace. And we can look at the other, what we think of as other, and know that there is no other. And in that, the third noble truth arises, is that our reactivity in the situation is relieved. And that is where the thinking heart becomes so important. We can look with clear eyes at the situation and we can choose how we want to respond. We have a choice. How to respond, when to respond, or even whether to respond. If we need to do anything at all. Maybe the heart of compassion is all that's needed in the situation. And there's a kind of confidence then in where we sit, where we stand, in facing the dukkha and being with the dukkha, being with the easy situation or the difficult person or the heart of our own suffering, our own conditioned suffering. And there can be a kind of wholeheartedness in the way we respond. It's not like we're responding because we should respond, or we think this maybe is the best way. There's a wholeheartedness And the response is the yarn that we use, the thread that we used to weave the tapestry of our life. The circumstances that arise in our life is what we have to weave with. The circumstances of our childhood, the circumstances of this very moment. It's what we've been given in order to weave a beautiful tapestry of our lives. Whatever is given, that is then the context. And again, Dogen said, he wrote this very wonderful book about instructions to the cook. And he said, whatever ingredients you are given, and this came out, truly out of the monastery where he was teaching. You know, Dogen has a really interesting history in that he was run out of several temples in Kyoto. And through real violence often, you know, like his one temple was burned. And it was because he was really threatening, what he was teaching was threatening to sort of the established ideas of what practice was, the big sangha at Mount Hiei, which was a Tendai sangha. And he was teaching what, you know, became Soto Zen, and the establishment was very, very threatened by what he was teaching. And twice they ran him out of temples, they burned his temples. And he went, you know, way into the mountains with just one other disciple, and you know, began building a new third temple. And there was often time when they didn't have any food. They didn't have, you know, they were just working from nothing. And he was always very positive. Yeah. And he would say to the cook, you know, whatever ingredients you have, make the most beautiful soup. Whether it was just pine needles, you can still make a beautiful soup. Whatever you're given in your life, that's what you cook with. Whatever's happened to you, that's what you weave with. And you make a beautiful tapestry. It's possible. But it's deep work. It's transformative work. You know what I've seen over and over again in the years of my life and teaching, that everybody wants to be liked. Everybody wants to have some recognition. And because people care really deeply, they're often very deeply self-critical. And those are really important threads in our lives. And if we don't recognize them, we get driven around by them. We get pushed around. If we really have a deep need for recognition and in a situation we're not being recognized, somebody else's jealousy arises instantly. And maybe hatred of the other person, or the person doing the recognizing. And then we try to get even with them. And we just get caught spinning and creating a huge amount of suffering. And it was all because we didn't get the recognition we thought we were supposed to have. And we never got to the bottom of it. Or we didn't feel well enough liked in a certain situation. So then we decide, well, I don't like that person after all. And then we talk about that person behind their back. Say, they're a bad person. And create a horrible amount of suffering because of it. You know, what I think happens so often, you know, we might all find ourselves in this situation of is that, you know, we're feeling we're not sure about something we did or we said. And first we're critical of ourselves, oh, I should have done that differently, or gosh, I should have been more mindful, or whatever the words are. And then immediately we turn it around and criticize somebody else. Well, if that person had helped me more, I could have done a better job. You know, it's always about ourselves being inadequate in some way, or and at the same time, it gets flipped around to the projection. And it's either we're beating ourselves up or we're projecting on somebody else. We're either judging ourselves. And those are the same thing. So whenever we notice that kind of negativity arising, you know, to take ourselves in hand and, you know, watch it, see it. See it for what it is, you know, like self-criticism. And then how it immediately flips over to somebody else. Projection. And then it comes back on us. And we get caught, you know, in that, you know, and then we, when we're criticizing ourselves, then we have to defend ourselves. And if somebody else is criticizing us, we have to defend ourselves against that. Because we think we have a self that needs defending. And the Buddha said, just stop and see it for what it is. Let it be. And come back. Come back to the trees. Come back to your breath. Come back to the bell. Come back to the taste of your food. Come back to this step. Come back to just sweeping. Nothing else. It is a deep practice to come back. And it is the basis for healing. When things keep coming up, you know, when we find we keep beating ourselves up about something, or we're really pissed off at somebody else and it keeps coming up, we know that it's not yet resolved. We haven't really understood. And then our commitment is to reside in the still heart, which doesn't mean doing nothing. It means doing what is right in front of us, sauteing the onions, doing the laundry, pulling the weeds. And our mind goes, yeah, la, 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 and we come back right to where it is. And, you know, sometimes things just disappear. You know, it's like we see them come, we see them go. And they don't have a big hold on us. And that, as we practice, becomes more and more the way. But when something keeps coming up, it's important to ask a question. And when we come back to reside in the still heart, eventually an answer will come. And we know it's true. We'll know completely that it's true. It is really difficult to understand this, but things as they are perfect, just as they are. We don't necessarily see that, but we are practicing it. You know, we see the mistaken threads in our lives. We see where the yarn has gotten all bunched up. We see the skipped loops and the holes. But we have to remember that the warp is always holding, always supporting the weaving of the threads. And it's perfect. It is steady. It's untouched by the bunches and the holes. And it equally supports the places where the tapestry is beautiful, as well as where there are mistakes. Yeah, in practicing this way, we do come to understand that there is no self or other in suffering in life. You know, our concern about death is equally about our own death as it is about the drowning of a Syrian refugee. It's like two things. And when we've seen the warp and the woof, we've seen through death into the deathless. We've touched the illuminated threads that support the tapestry of our life. Then our fear leaves us. The images of suffering that keep appearing, we say this too. And looking into the deathless, where there's no coming and going, where there's no self and other, there's no right or wrong, is a place of freedom for us. Is the place where our reactivity in the world can cease. But we don't live here. We can't live here. You know, the spirit of all of us, of the universe, is absolutely free. The still heart, the warp that underlies our life. It's a vast ocean of emptiness that mysteriously manifests as inseparable from being. Rilke calls it the unsayable. And we live in the very midst of it, all the time. But that reality has no power to change things. It's only the weaving that makes the tapestry. And we have to step forth from that place that unborn, undying, of no opinion, no right, no wrong, no separation. We have to step forth from that place into the marketplace. Into the world of this and that, of right and wrong, of good and bad, of you and me. And this is the fourth noble truth, this is the path. And that step into that path is brand new each moment. The path is brand new each moment. From that place of vast, ever-changing, illuminated emptiness, it's really, if we get caught there, easy to say, oh yeah, well, everything's okay. Everything's allowable. There's no right or wrong. There's no good or bad. But the Buddha gave us precepts so that we didn't, and the precepts arise out of that vast heart of empty compassion. Because if there's no self or other, how else can we respond in the world but through non-harming? You know, I think this specific wording in the precepts isn't too important. However, the general outline is not killing, stealing, lying, not hurting ourselves, not hurting others. They are about non-harming, and they represent the thinking heart. They are the thinking heart that moves us to action in the world. They arise embodied from the warp and the woof of our lives. It is the basis for our response. If we take the precepts as simply as prescriptions, and initially when we first encounter them, precepts are mindfulness trainings, they do seem like don't do this, do that, and they're helpful in that sense because they point to something for us. But if we take them strictly as rules, as right and wrong, if we take them out of the heart of emptiness, then they become self-righteous. They lead to self-righteousness. Because as soon as we step into the world of right and wrong, it's like, well, I'm right and you're wrong. It's like if we use anything as an idea, it takes it out of the heart the emptiness. We speak a lot about compassion, and certainly non-harming comes out of compassion, and it is that compassionate nature. When we say emptiness, it is compassion. It's not different than that. But if we use compassion as an idea, then it's like, well, I'm supposed to be this way. And it stinks of pity or acting in a way that I think Pema Chodron calls it idiot compassion. And I speak about this because I see often, particularly in our tradition, we think we have to be compassionate all the time to everyone, no matter what they're doing. And what happens often is our compassion is then supportive of people in their neuroses, in their harming, in their brokenness. And then that brokenness gets allowed in a way that hurts other people. So that we support each other, we can support each other in our brokenness rather than in our healing and in our health. We support each other in continuing to create difficulties, rather than looking into the difficulties. And then that is understood as compassion. There is a certain fierceness that is essential in our practice. It's represented by Manjushri and Manjushri's sword, which is sometimes we just have to cut things off. And we have to learn how to use that sword for ourselves in our own hearts, in our own practice, when we find that there's a certain thought pattern that keeps coming up. A certain anxiety might be about not being good enough, might be about, you know, any of the things that come up inside of us. And as soon as it's that dukkha, we see it right away. And it takes the sword of Manjushri to cut through it so that we can then have the space for it not to run over us, not to pull us away, not to get lost in it. And that's a very much precision of breathing in, I know I'm breathing in, breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. That's Manjushri's sword. Breathing in, I know I'm caught in sleepiness. Breathing out, I know I'm caught in sleepiness. Manjushri's sword. So that the energy of wanting to be free from the dukkha is stronger than the dukkha. The wanting to be free, to step forth in the world as the embodiment of the Buddha mind, letting the warp of our lives that holds the tapestry be steady and perfect so it's not pulled around. Which of course it can't be pulled around. I'm mixing metaphors here, sorry. letting the weaving of our life be an expression of the warp, the steady straight warp. And it's because the warp of our lives is the warp of all existence. When we touch one strand, everything moves. And it's important that we understand that, because what is needed is a change in our consciousness, in our understanding of who and what we are. You know, we co-create the world in each moment. In the old way, there was thinking that everything, in natives and indigenous people thought that all things were filled with life. Trees, rocks, animals, they all had a spirit. And the spirit was within all things. It's like all things are one. And they recognize that. And we have evolved as our ability to see that reality is outside of ourselves. We've been able to objectify reality through science and through secular thought. And that's made it possible for us to separate from the great surround. The idea that it's all oneness. And to develop as independent beings. And to actualize our freedom. And that is also, is what led in many ways, I believe, to the abuse of the world around us. The abuse of other peoples. But it's only by separating from the whole that we can begin to ask who we are, what we are, and begin to discover our true relationship with the whole. And as we come to understand that relationship, you know, our power in it, and our power in it, we can begin to be more responsible and actively work to develop so that we, as a consciousness, as the warp of all existence, can begin to take our next step in evolution so that we become citizens of creation rather than lord and master. So that we become caretakers of the cosmos and each other. So we see that we are co-creating the world in each moment. And it means that we have to ultimately see into the light, into the warp that holds equally the good and the bad, that holds equally the suffering and the joy. To touch that illuminated nature of consciousness. And when we touch it, it feels like love. It is the basis. It is the foundation. And we begin to learn to trust whatever comes, whatever we see, whatever's happening, whatever the situation is, inside our own hearts and in the world around us. It is the great optimism of our practice. We say to be in the Discourse on Love, to be in the world with our hearts undisturbed by the world. That isn't exactly my intention. Of course we're disturbed. Of course we're hurt. Of course we hurt other people. But to look at that disturbance with the thinking heart and to know that that isn't all there is. It isn't just the weaving. It's the warp underneath holding it as well. It isn't just the waves. The ocean is there too. We live in this world. Our bodies fail us. It isn't the way we want it to be. And yet, at our hearts of hearts, the thinking heart, the still heart, is at peace. The ocean is our source, our support, but we live right in the midst of the waves and we don't try to escape them. Sometimes it's calmer, sometimes it's rougher. The warp supports the entire tapestry of existence. Your warp, my warp, the warp of our lives. It's not separate. The warp and weft are what complete the tapestry. They are not two things. They are completely interwoven. There are not two worlds, only this one. The ocean and the waves are not separate. They never have been and never can be. There's only this one world. And we can only meet it in all its fullness and vastness in this moment. In this moment. In this moment. So whatever presents itself, whatever is your life, whatever thought, whatever feeling, whatever perception, whatever your body gives you, just this. And we come back, not separating ourselves from anything, from what's right here, right now. And this is the fourth noble truth. This is the path, and each moment it is illuminated. And whether we know it or not, we too are that very illumination.